You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us. On the program today, writer Tom Bissell joins us to talk about the former Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan and the destruction of the Aral Sea. Tom Bissell is the author of Chasing the Sea, Lost Among the Ghosts of Empire in Central Asia. His first journey to Uzbekistan was as a Peace Corps volunteer in the 1990s. That journey and his service were cut short, but Bissell was hooked on the country. He returned in 2001 to report on Uzbekistan and the Aral Sea, a body of water that in 1960 was the size of Lake Michigan. Now, within a few years, the sea could disappear. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Tom Bissell, this afternoon. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. This is from the biographical sketch on the jacket of Chasing the Sea. Tom Bissell was born in Escanaba, Michigan in 1974. He worked for several years as a book editor. His criticism, fiction, and journalism have appeared in Harper's, Men's Journal, Esquire, McSweeney's, The Boston Review, and Best American Travel Writing 2003, among other publications. He has been nominated for several awards and not received any of them. He lives in New York City. His book, Chasing the Sea, is published by Pantheon Books. Again, and the listeners, those numbers to call if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Tom Bissell, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. You say when you left Uzbekistan, you were done with the place, but it was not done with you. What was it about this country that got hold of you?
Well, as anyone who has read the book can tell you, I had a sort of emotional flame out, I guess, when I was there as a Peace Corps volunteer. The only explanation I can really give is that I went from Escanaba, Michigan, to East Lansing, Michigan, where I was in school, to suddenly finding myself in the former Soviet Union. And that sort of trans-dimensional leap broke my mind. And I just wasn't ready for the experience. I was a pretty young man at the time. I was 22 years old, and I just don't think I was prepared to just deal with a lot of the stuff that I was suddenly experiencing. And yet, when I returned home, because it did have such a profound impact on my mind, and particularly on my writing, I found myself, all the stories that I wanted to write, because I am also a fiction writer, were all set in Central Asia. So something about the place, the drama of it in my mind, the drama of experiencing it, it is such a strange place. It is such a wonderful place in a lot of ways, and it is such a place that it is a place that so few Americans or Westerners in particular have really had a lot of experience with, and all of that stuff. Just, I think the more distant I got from the experience, the more beguiled I was, and the more I found myself thinking about it and wanting to go back and try to have another go at it, I guess. And I think it is the reality that foreign travel is such a intoxicating thing when you get hooked on it. It's very frightening at first when you're not used to it. But I just got hooked on Central Asia. I read, 2-3 years worth of books on the place, and now I find myself a sort of unreconstructed Central Asian addict. That's really the best explanation I can have, is that a place that hurts you or wounds you. I guess it's like a first love. you always forget the one who broke your heart.
Yeah,
and that very intense feeling is still there.
Yeah. There's a scene in the book when you're back in the country and you go to the American embassy and meet with the press officer. He complains that some of the reporting done on the region has been unfair. I got a number of questions here. What was the press officer complaining about? What do you think about the reporting done on Central Asia? And what are the challenges of reporting on this region?
Yeah, well, the first part of the question I will answer, I do sort of address a couple of the writers who have written about Central Asia in ways that I certainly regard as unfair, and that I think he may have been obliquely addressing. One is a writer, Robert Kaplan, who is probably the most famous travel writer we have today, who traveled Uzbekistan in 1994 and had a long section of it in his book, The Ends of the Earth. And I do have a certain amount of regard and respect for Kaplan, but his stuff in Uzbekistan, I think, is a real embodiment of it. He goes there and he complains that the architecture is ugly, that the people wear shabby clothing, that the cars are dented and things like that, without stopping to wonder, well, why are the cars dented? Why do the people wear shabby clothing, which I would say they don't necessarily. You know, why is the architecture ugly? The fact is that people in Central Asia lived, for 70 years under, totalitarian Soviet rule. And 3 years after they declared their independence, a lot of people seem to wonder, well, why aren't things better, Why aren't they, why can't they do this? Why can't they do that? Why is sort of the tenets of kind of market economy so hard for these people to grasp? Well, they're hard for these people to grasp because they never had to grasp it before. Centralized sort of state planning is, for 7 decades of it, you don't really just break out of that spell instantly. And I think a lot of the Western writers became very frustrated with a lot of the administrative and kind of bureaucratic tangles that you find in that part of the world. But stop and think about it, it's totally normal and rational that these problems would persist, so soon after a country finds itself sort of cast free from the empire to which it belonged. and the second part of the question was, what are some of the problems that reporters have, I think? And I would say that a similar sort of problem is that for 7 decades, most of Central Asia was fairly hard to get into, fairly hard to breach as a journalist. Most journalists don't have, Russian language skills. There are some exceptions, like David Remnick and Jeffrey Taylor and Andrew Meyer, all of whom have written books about the former Soviet Union and the Soviet Union, all of which are great, but I think they're the exception. A lot of, foreign correspondents don't necessarily know the languages of the places they travel to. I'm certainly no exception to that. I have rudimentary skills in Uzbek and horrifically bad skills in Russian, but I certainly couldn't read any of the official kind of information that is available in those languages. That's just beyond my ken. So having only access to Western stuff about that part of the world, which is, there's not a lot of information about it, and all of that hampers one's ability to sort of write about that culture. And of course, the Muslim world, in particular the former Soviet Muslim world, is a place that has been sealed off in all sorts of ways, culturally, economically, politically. And, over the last 15 years, we've sort of had our first, as Westerners, first long interaction and communication with that part of the world. And, we're meeting these people for the first time in a lot of ways, and, of course, there's going to be lots of misunderstandings and lots of mutual misunderstandings. So I think all of these things feed into a lot of the reporting that has been done in the region. And I think that's changing now thanks, to the war. In Afghanistan in particular, a lot of journalists were suddenly wandering around Central Asia, and I think more than a few of them were sort of beguiled by it, and I know a couple who've done more reporting on it and gone back. And I think the more reporters that do visit the region, the more reporters that are going to realize that there are so many wonderful and amazing and sometimes horrifying stories in that part of the world that this block that we have will slowly erode, I hope. Yeah. I hope Chasing the Sea is, some evidence that has already begun, that an American publisher, A, would want to publish a book about Uzbekistan and B, support it and do stuff for it. I think that it's really, an amazing thing, at least for me and for the people for whom Central Asia means something.
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting read. It's a good read. And it's such an eye-opening read. I mean, I don't know anything about, or I didn't know anything about Uzbekistan. Now I know a little. And I think that maybe here what we should do is talk a little bit about some basic things about this place. We know it's in Central Asia. We know it's, I had to, I looked at the map as I went along. It's nestled in between Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan.
And Afghanistan.
The southern border touches Afghanistan. So now the listeners, I think, have some kind of a grounding here a little bit. And the Aral Sea lies in two countries, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. What else should we know? Should we know a little bit more here at this point in the interview about the geography of the region?
Sure. Well, the first thing to know about Central Asia is that, you know, for the majority of recorded human history, it was in a massively important place, both politically and for trade reasons. The Silk Road, which is actually a series of roads, they call it the Silk Road, but it should actually be called the Silk Roads, that went from Greece to China, went smack through the middle of Uzbekistan. And its three biggest and most glorious cities, Bukhara, Samarkand, and Tashkent, were all very important cities along the Silk Road. So what you have in Uzbekistan is where sort of China met the Mediterranean, where India met Europe, where Islam met Orthodox Christianity, where all of these historical and human forces and endeavors sort of collided and merged into this really interesting, strange culture. The people, I should point out, are not, they're Muslims, but of course they're not Arabs. They're Turco-Mongol people, which means they're ethnically a result of Turkish and Mongol mixing in the middle of the Asian subcontinent. And Central Asia has had some very celebrated passers through and native sons from Alexander the Great, who wandered through, to Marco Polo, of course, wandered through. Genghis Khan was born in the area and subdued most of it. Tamerlane, who probably conquered more land than any single human being ever in the history of the world and established his capital in Uzbekistan in the 1400s, ruled out of what is today called Uzbekistan. So you see that this part of the world has had, through history, amazing ramifications for the rest of the world. And one thing September 11th did is remind us that Central Asia, which you think is a obscure part of the world that no one really knows about, that again and again through history, it suddenly reestablishes itself as a very important place. And of course, when we realized that a bunch of Islamists had been scheming and plotting in the hills of the deserts of Afghanistan, that it is to our own peril that we ignore Central Asia, because the ripples that spread out from it often have massive complications and ramifications for the rest of the world. The geography of Uzbekistan is pretty varied. In the west, where the Aral Sea is, it's mostly desert, and most of the cities of Uzbekistan are found where its oases exist, off of two major rivers, the Sirdarya and the Amudarya, which are the main tributaries to the Aral Sea, which have been diverted from the Aral Sea, which is why it's disappearing. And when you get to the east of Uzbekistan, where it meets Kyrgyzstan and comes very close to broaching Chinese Turkestan, which is the Turkic part of China, you see a place, a wonderful place called the Fergana Valley, which is this beautifully picturesque mountain-nestled series of towns, and one of the really most jaw-droppingly beautiful natural settings I've certainly ever seen. And that's the most fertile part of Central Asia, and it's also where most of the people live. 20% of the entire region's population lives in the Fergana Valley. So you see a lot of geographical variance in Uzbekistan, and there is no one Uzbekistan. It's like every country. There are many parts of it, and that's one of the things that is so interesting about Uzbekistan. Unlike most of the other Central Asian countries, Kazakhstan, for instance, is dominated by the steppe. Turkmenistan is dominated by desert. Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are dominated by mountains. But Uzbekistan seems to have a little of all of them, you know, and that's, I think, probably why it is kind of the most appealing of the former Soviet stans.
Yeah. The region is Islamic, but it's also quite secular.
Yes, very secular.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I've found great hope in the Islam of Central Asia, and it's a very important point to make. Oftentimes, and certainly our current administration has not always helped the matter, the Islamic world is not like some united monolith, you know, against which the West is struggling. There are many Islams, there are many different kinds of Islam, and the Islam of Central Asia is always, well, not always, but has typically been a more moderated, calmer, less ideological form of Islam. For instance, Sufism, which is a branch of Islam that is very joyous and involves lots of singing and dancing and spinning. The term whirling dervish comes from Sufi Muslims. Sufism was created in Central Asia, and Sufism was a reaction to early Islam's obsession with legality and jurisprudence and things like that. So you see the Central Asian kind of Islam is very different from Middle Eastern Islam. Like you say, it's much more secular, but 70 years of Soviet atheism as well have really, in some ways, it's had a very positive influence, that sort of diluting of a kind of really reactionary Islam, but in some instances it's had very negative repercussions. It cut off most Central Asians from their religious heritage, and so a lot of religious kind of, I call them Islamist neo-fascists, have used Central Asians, you know, a lot of poor, younger Central Asian men's ignorance of Islam to promote this version of Islam that is violent, that is reactionary, that the fact that the Russians were so anti-Islam for so many decades, a lot of young men have sort of swallowed this, scholars call it parallel Islam, which is an Islam that is founded on nothing but highly questionable tenets and often very sketchy understandings of what Islam is and how it is practiced by the majority of peaceful Muslims around the world.
Mm. Writer Tom Bissell is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Chasing the Sea, Lost Among the Ghosts of Empire in Central Asia. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. The phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon joins us from Chicago on this Thursday, the 23rd of October, where this evening he'll be at the Savvy Traveler on South Michigan Avenue for a reading and a book signing. That's the Savvy Traveler in Chicago at 6 o'clock this evening. I want to ask you about your first hosts on your way back into country, into the country of Uzbekistan. You say when you're a guest there, you've got to be a superlative guest.
Yeah.
Tell us about being the guest of Oleg and Natasha.
Well, Oleg and Natasha are Russian people that I live, that I stay with in Tashkent when I first arrived in Uzbekistan in the beginning of the book, and I sort of use them as a way to talk about what some have called, I don't coin the phrase, but in the book I don't attribute it, called a guerrilla hospitality, which is this hospitality at any cost. It is one of the most wonderful things about Central Asia that I can really imagine. Of course, hospitality is very important throughout a lot of Muslim cultures, but in Central Asia they seem to have taken it to an absolutely ridiculous end. I mean, you get the sense that a lot of people there would spend their life savings to throw a goodbye party for you, or do anything for you when you're a guest there, and it just comes from this intense hospitality that people feel, that you're their guest, that you are their responsibility, and they will do everything that they can to make you comfortable and happy. And like I say, I mean, I've had lots of troubles in Central Asia, or I've had a car break down, and you just walk up to someone's door and knock on it, and next thing you know, they're on the phone, their brother's coming over, they're helping you change the tire. It's really an amazing thing, and I can only praise that aspect of Central Asian culture. And Oleg and Natasha are certainly embodiments of that. You know, with very little prodding or asking, that they took me into their lives in a way that was just remarkable, and really helped me sort of get established back into the country. And you find that throughout the region. It's really, I think every tourist who goes there. Obviously, it's not always an easy place to travel in for various reasons, but the people really make the place as special and as wonderful as it is.
Yeah, and now another special person, your guide.
Rustam.
Yeah, Rustam.
Yeah.
Smart and fun and funny and kicking it up, dude.
Rustam was an exchange student in California, and I should say that when I first went there, it started out as a magazine piece I was writing for Harper's, and it was just going to be about the Aral Sea, and then suddenly my literary agent had showed the magazine proposal to a book editor, and for reasons I will never understand, I was offered a contract to write a book about the trip. And at the time, I was just absolutely baffled. I had no reason to think that I had a book in me about this. I thought maybe I had a good-sized and strong magazine piece, but I thought to myself, there's no book in this. And I was very, very, very scared and sad about that, and I thought I was going to just fall on my face. And then I met Rustam, who is a young man who's in half Uzbek and half Tajik, incredibly smart, incredibly funny, a great guy and a great person. And I realized the instant I met him that here was the book in some crucial sense. This guy, I was going to go with him, and he was going to go with me, and we became friends, very close friends, very quickly. That's one thing that the book doesn't really fudge, is how instantly and how quickly we became very, very close friends, and how he stopped being my translator. And you'll notice, if you've read the book, he doesn't really do a whole lot of translating for me. You know, we just mostly just hang out together. And I realized that in this young man, who you see all of these warring things, you see the proud former citizen of the Soviet Union. Rustam is very up on the Soviet Union. He really misses being a Soviet. He really felt proud of that. You see that. You see the distaste for radical Islam in him. You see the Western influences. He loves Depeche Mode and the rock group Offspring, and he loves video games. And you also see the kind of traditional remnants of Central Asian culture, a kind of vague unease with women being positions of authority, and a vague discomfort with sexual matters with women and things like that. You see all of these things in this incredibly good-natured, good-hearted young man. You see all of these forces boiling within him, and I knew that I was going to have a book if I could just follow him and listen to him and talk to him and go places with him.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the engine of the book, is Rustam's and my deepening relationship.
Yeah, and I think he comes to embody the place.
Yeah.
In all its complexity.
Yeah. It's one of the things I didn't write about, perhaps I should have, is that a lot of the long, painful discussions Rustam and I have had about, say, Joseph Stalin, for instance. Joseph Stalin was, by any metric, one of the most miserable human beings who ever walked the planet. And Rustam still maintains that he's the best leader the Soviets ever had, and he knows about the gulags. He's read Solzhenitsyn in Russian, I might add, and it's this weird remnant of that respect for authority, that respect for order, and he's under the impression that under Stalin, things were better, things were orderly. You know, people did what they had to do, and I've seen in that there's just this gulf between us that, as a Westerner, I just cannot comprehend, and he cannot comprehend my incomprehension of it. And that, I think, the friendship combined with that gulf that exists between us, and that perhaps will always exist between us, is, I think, one of the saddest, but I hope sort of most mysterious parts of the book and that friendship.
Yeah. It was surprising to me to learn that the republics of Central Asia were reluctant to break free from the Soviet Union.
Very much so, which is strange because they were some of the fiercest objectors to initial Soviet and Tsarist colonization. I think there are lots of reasons for that. The major reason is that they were, they went from having 96% illiteracy and basically a fairly primitive farming and nomadic societies. The amazing thing the Soviets did was modernize parts of the world. Modernize in quotes, but still, modernize by any reasonable use of that term. They modernized a part of the world that was basically had remained fairly unchanged since the 1400s. And I think educated Central Asians appreciated that, and they knew that everything they had was underwritten by Moscow. And I think a lot of them sensed that Russia, without Soviet Union, of course, is one republic, and Soviet Union without Moscow and without the Soviet underpinning of their economy, that things were going to be very bad for all of them. And, of course, the other thing the Russians did is they ruled Central Asia through native surrogates. And the problem in any dictatorship, in any authoritarian society, is not that they have a dictator. It's the triangle of people whose livelihoods depend on having that dictator in power. So what you have is one dictator with, any number of how many ever thousand smaller dictators underneath them who depend on that dictator for getting their sons in fancy schools and their fancy cars and all that. So the problem is not unseating a dictator. It's unseating all those people who absolutely depend on that dictator being in power. And in Central Asia, you saw that dynamic play out. Without the Russians, the native ruling elite, I think, was very terrified about their chances at surviving the upheaval. Sadly, the native elite has done just fine in the years that Central Asia has become independent, and they're all still there. But I think a lot of them were very frightened that they weren't going to be.
Let's talk with a listener now, a caller waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Good afternoon. Why were the two rivers dammed up that supplied the Aral Sea?
That's a very good question. You have to go all the way back to 1865, the American Civil War.
Whoa.
Which is when Russia lost its cotton supplier, which was the American South. Russia looked around itself and realized it needed a quick access to lots of cotton and a place to grow it. Of course, some of Russia is Arctic and subarctic, and it's not a very hospitable place to growing cotton. Neither were the deserts of Central Asia, it turns out, but the Tsarist Russians thought they could do something about that. So what they did is they began to divert the various feeder rivers to the Aral Sea, and they flooded the desert and began to grow an extraordinary amount of cotton. The plan worked. In fact, it worked so well that when the Bolshevik Revolution occurred, the Soviets decided to do the same thing, but they quickly grew impatient with the small amounts of cotton that they were able to grow and decided willy-nilly to completely divert the feeder rivers and amp things up to an absolutely ecocidally insane extent. And by 1960, it was basically Soviet policy that none of these feeder rivers were going to reach the Aral Sea, and the irrigation schemes went into overdrive, combined with the fact that there were about seven times as many Central Asians in the 1960s as there were, say, at the turn of the century. And all of these factors combined to essentially begin to drain and dry up the Aral Sea, which is the best, most concise explanation I have as to how the whole horrible disaster began to take shape.
Wow. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thanks for the call this afternoon, and I want to thank the listener for getting us around to this topic, because I really want to talk about this, this part of the book, Chasing the Sea. Tom, you say we've made a Faustian bargain throughout the world with industrialization and with agriculture, and you just referred to ecocide. Can we undo that Faustian bargain?
Well, that's a tough one. As I say in the book, I think maybe human progress historically has always come at the price of obscuring some small part of the world to, you know, basically horrific living conditions. And while Moscow bureaucrats and bureaucrats in Tashkent and Uzbekistan were getting rich on the cotton grist, the people of Western Uzbekistan were suffering the consequences. And I think as the world, quote-unquote, grows smaller, I really don't like that phrase because the world still seems plenty big to me, but certainly we're more connected. Certainly we have more access to information from anywhere we want in the world. And I think as this process goes on, we're going to begin to understand that chopping down the forests of Indonesia for logging affects someone, probably the indigenous people of the Indonesian forests. You know, chopping down the Brazilian rainforests, of course, hurts everyone. Draining the Aral Sea for socks and trousers for Moscow soldiers, of course, doomed the people of Western Uzbekistan. I think the bargain is that environment and the environments that we live in are finite. You know, they have life spans just like any person. They can live, they die. Sometimes they don't come back. And business and industry, which I hope anyone who reads the book will realize that I'm not anti-business and I'm not anti-industry at all. Industry is one of the cornerstones of the human endeavor, but the moral they all see especially suggests that business needs to be watched and hemmed in, and you need to make sure business, which I view as a kind of inanimate thing, which is not really run by people, it sort of has its own consciousness in the sense that the duty of business is to make money, and it will do so until it can't anymore. And if you leave environmental protection in the hands of businesses, I think most businesses, unless they are run by, you know, men and women of Gandhi-like souls, will suck and drain and dry these environments until there's not a single dollar to be made anymore. And the irony is, of course, is not only does that destroy the environment, it eventually will destroy the business itself. And that is absolutely the case of what has happened in Western Uzbekistan with the Aral Sea. Mm-hmm. The sea was drained to make money. Well, the sea is now drained, and there's not much more money to be made. And whereas a rational policy would have ensured the survival of the Aral Sea and probably less money, but ultimately, you know, it would have been much more beneficial for everyone had patience and restraint been used.
One of the things I found myself thinking about was this question: what does it mean to be an environmentalist?
That's a very good question. I should probably confess that I came to environmentalism through the Aral Sea. I did not and really don't consider myself that ardent an environmentalist. And one of the things I rather like about the book is that it's not really an environmental book in the sense that you sense an environmentally slanted writer sort of talking about this problem. I'd like to think that I talk about it as more of a concerned citizen than an ideological environmentalist. And that's not to say that I'm against the ideology of environmentalism, but people who are committed environmentalists, of course, have... It's a political philosophy that necessarily means there are all sorts of beliefs and systems, turns of thought and systems of thought that I personally think that I don't have to the extent that most kind of card-carrying environmentalists have. So what does it mean to be an environmentalist? I think it means what I was just talking about, a basic understanding that environments, all environments, are, like I said, they're finite and they can die. And in the long run, we probably really can't hurt or destroy the Earth. You know, 5,000 years, the Aral Sea could return and be fine again. But the problem is none of us are going to be alive then, you know. So even though the environment is a very big picture, we can't live as though it is. We have to live as though it's a very small picture because we have to live in that small picture, all of us. And if we constantly think about big picture issues when, in fact, the small picture is devastated, well, I'm not sure what kind of a deal we're getting, you know. It's not a very good deal at all. So I think an environmentalist is someone who is intensely mindful of the challenges of ensuring, you know, human prosperity and human health and things like that, but also keeping in human business and money and economics, but also keeping in mind that there are things that are bigger than all of those questions. And the bigger question is the survival of human culture in places that depend upon the survival of the environments that they live in.
Mm-hmm. The human footprint is just so huge. I mean, the maps that you include in the book are so striking, the before and after maps. There were once cities that touched the sea, mm-hmm. No longer.
Yeah, so the major city is a city called Moynoc, which in 1960 was this fairly pretty resort community that Soviet bureaucrats went to. I've actually seen archival footage of Moynoc from the late 1950s, and you see these beautiful beaches and waves and sailboats and kids playing, and it's absolutely heartbreaking to think about that footage when the reality is now Moynoc is 100 miles away from the Aral Sea, between 80 and 100 miles. The sea is shrinking so fast that map makers can't keep pace, which is an amazing thing. Today it's you know 80 to 100 miles away, and you can't see, obviously, the Aral Sea from Moynoc anymore, and this town of 40,000 people now has about 1,800 people, all of whom have horrible disease problems, cancer problems, tuberculosis problems, due to the pollution that was dumped by the Soviet Union into the Aral Sea, which, as it has withdrawn, has exposed a seabed, which is filled with poison dust, basically, which now blows all over all the people. So, yes, these cities that were once these seaside communities filled with people who historically were nomads and fishermen who now have nowhere to go and nothing to catch because all the fish are dead, is an astonishing thing to think about, and it's an astonishing place to visit. Mm. It truly is.
How has it changed? How did it change between 1996 when you were there first and when you went back in 2001?
Well, I never visited the Aral Sea region when I was there as a Peace Corps volunteer. I was far away from that part of the country. I was in the central part of the country, and at that time, the Aral Sea was really spoken of in very ominous, doomed overtones. And so I never really got to see it. The talk of it, the people there don't really talk about it very much for reasons that are not really that surprising. There's really nothing to say anymore. The sea is dead. It's not going to come back. It's problems that undid it are too complicated and intertwined now to undo. There's really not much that can be done anymore. And there's really not a lot left to say about it, especially when the perpetrator of the disaster, the Soviet Union, no longer exists. It's like imagining a murderer, an axe murderer, breaking into your house and chopping up your family, who then disappears in a puff of smoke. You know, who do you go to? No one. There's no one to go to anymore. There's nothing anyone can do about it. My understanding is that in 1996, there was still a slight amount of optimism from international groups who were working on the problem. But by 2001, just about everyone I talked to had basically conceded that it was getting worse, it was going to keep getting worse, and at this point there was little anyone could do other than just trying to contain the health problems and making sure the people who lived there had some semblance of endurable existence.
Yeah. The scale of this disaster is so enormous. Could a disaster like this happen elsewhere?
Well, the Soviet Union was experts at destroying the environment. The Aral Sea is probably the worst thing they did, but the Caspian Sea was damaged considerably by the Soviet Union. Lake Balkhash, which is in Kyrgyzstan, was damaged significantly. There are other lakes and rivers throughout the Soviet Union that suffered severe ecological damage. But, for instance, Kazakhstan has horrible problems with all of the nuclear airburst and below ground burst the Soviet Union did, something like 800 explosions over the 40 year period that they tested. And of course, the areas around those places now are pretty awful. I mean, they have problems from like birth defects to mutated spiders. It's like a comic book, you know. And of course, there's Chernobyl, which still has casts a very long shadow upon the people of the Ukraine. So there are many disasters throughout the Soviet Union that are still lingering. Whether or not something like that big could happen in another part of the world, I'm not sure. I certainly hope not. Some people have quibbled with my calling the Aral Sea disaster the world's worst man-made ecological catastrophe. They point out that the eventual destruction of the Brazilian rainforest, for instance, could ultimately pose much greater human consequences. But I counter that by saying, well, that is a disaster that's still unfolding. There's still hope for that disaster. The Aral Sea, of course, the books are closed on this disaster. It's over. It happened. And now the people of that region and, of course, all of us all over the world now have to ponder what the lessons of that disaster are.
Tom, we have to wrap it up here. I want to thank you very much for spending the time with us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I thank you for having me.
Tom Bissell has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Chasing the Sea, Lost Among the Ghosts of Empire in Central Asia. The book is published by Pantheon Books.